I'll have you know, the contents of that dumpster are private. You stick your nose in, you'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality.
I just wanted to say hello.
Oh. Hello.
All right, we're done.
You think the language in the Second Amendment is clear enough? You know, about the right to bear arms?
Of course it's clear. Every American has the right to hang a pair of bear arms on their wall. How could that possibly be misconstrued?
All right, fantastic then. Wait, you know what? Before we send this to the printer, let's take that abortion thing out.
Oh, come on. I move for a hearing on the matter.
What? You want me to have a special motion on the admissibility of the word asshole?
Well, let me have ass then. That's close enough.
What law school did you go to?
I'll agree to it, Your Honor.
You will? Why?
I don't want any interlocutory appeals.
What are you, a comedy team?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that breaks down the law behind all the news stories you care about. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hey guys, I'm Liz Dye. With me is Andrew Torres, and this is Opening Arguments, episode 739.
Hey Liz, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I am equally great.
Fantastic.
So Liz, I don't know if you know this or not, but the 2020 presidential election was not stolen.
The devil you say.
Yeah. So there was not widespread voter fraud. There were not thousands of mules paid by George Soros to deposit fake absentee ballots.
Oh,
there
no,
not...
I saw a movie about that. It definitely happened.
So did our $2 patrons. Outstanding plug. You're getting good at this. There were not thousands of votes by dead people or suitcases full of ballots trucked in under cover of darkness. And, you know, we have, I'm going to say, 787 million reasons to know that the voting machines that tabulated the votes were not connected to the internet. They weren't hacked from China or Venezuela or whatever. And every result from every machine was tied to a verifiable paper trail. So anyone who tells you otherwise is lying to you.
You're right. And that is a perfect segue to today's show, which features an interesting interview with two lawyers who got in a pillow fight with that weirdo Mike Lindell, and they won.
Yay!
They hail from the litigation firm Bailey Glasser, and they represented Robert Zeidman, an inventor who took Lindell up on his offer of $5 million to anyone who could prove that the data he was citing as evidence that China had hacked the election wasn't what he said it was. So let's set the stage. In August of 2021, Lindell invited all his supporters to Sioux Falls, South Dakota for a rootin' tootin' cyber fraud hootenanny showdown. And like 90% sure that's what it was called. I don't know. Whatever. Maybe not. You could come. You could register as press, although they kind of hounded a lot of the press out of there. But there was a special contest you could only enter with approval from Mike Lindell in advance. We will get to that. But while you were there, you could not only see the multimedia presentation by Lindell claiming that China changed Trump votes into Biden votes, but Lindell promised to give anyone who wanted a copy of the full packet capture data that would supposedly show, with timestamps, votes being changed in real times. But only if you were approved in advance could you also participate in the, this is really what it's called. I didn't make this one up. I know I have been known to make a nickname, but no, it really, really was called the Prove Mike Wrong Challenge.
So you may infer that that contest didn't attract a whole lot of people actually interested in, you know, proving Mike Lindell wrong. But it did draw at least one who submitted his results. And we'll learn more about his motives during the interview. We will also link to these contest rules in the show notes. But here's the Cliff Notes version, right? So the rules were drafted by Kurt Olson. And you may recognize that name as one of the lawyers that got sanctioned by the courts for lying about election fraud on behalf of Carrie Lake. The challenge was also adjudicated by a three-judge panel selected by Mike Lindell, and that three-judge panel included Kurt Olson.
What?
So when Robert Zeidman played by the rules and proved Mike wrong by showing that the data provided was not even packet capture data at all, let alone, you know, packet capture data of votes, we'll forgive you for being less than shocked that Kurt Olson didn't award Zeidman the $5 million.
And
that left Zeidman no choice but to arbitrate his claim against Lindell, who was then represented in the arbitration by, drumroll please, Kurt Olson. So that's some catch, that catch 22.
Yeah. And while we're focused on this FACACTA packet capture data claim, let's not forget that a bunch of other crazy shit went down there, including the live stream video of someone breaking into Dominion voting machines in Mesa County, Colorado, which is how the world came to meet Tina Peters, that loony woman who got indicted for a bunch of felonies after stealing a contractor's ID and sneaking her goon into a Dominion voting machine's trusted build. That's the update of their machines, which then made it not a trusted build and, of course, caused all the vulnerabilities she was looking for in the first place and caused the county to have to buy new machines because these were now contaminated. Yeah. So, look, we would probably cover this story anyway because it's funny, but it's not funny that Lindell is one of the primary, you know, sewage pipes continuing to spew out election misinformation. On just yesterday's show, we learned that the lawyers representing fake electors in Georgia continue to this day in May of 2023 to spew obvious lies about how none of their bogus fraud claims have ever been adjudicated on their merits. And these sanitized lies are deliberately designed to keep reassuring millions of people that it's perfectly reasonable to believe that the 2020 election was stolen. And that's super, super dangerous. So with that in mind, let's get to our interview. And we will get to our interview after this brief ad break.
Hey, everybody. This is an ad for Bombas. They make getting active more comfortable with great socks, breathable t-shirts, and underwear made to move with you. So Bombas is designed for every activity. Look, if you're walking or running like me, you'll love their left, right foot contoured running socks. They're a perfect fit that won't slide in your shoe. If you're into yoga like Liz, if you're into competitive sports, whatever you do to get active, Bombas takes sweat wicking, blister preventing, and friction reducing very seriously. And I also love when we get to talk about social consciousness from our advertisers that share our values. Socks, underwear, and t-shirts are literally the number 1, 2, and 3 most requested items in homeless shelters. That's why for each and every item you purchase, Bombas will donate another item to someone experiencing homelessness. I love that. And better still, if you experience any wear and tear with your Bombas items, Bombas will replace them for life. So go to bombas.com/openingarguments and use code openingarguments for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/openingarguments, OPENINGARGUMENTS, all one word. And use that same code, openingarguments, all one word, at checkout. bombas.com/openingarguments for 20% off your first purchase. This is an ad for Shady Rays, the sunglass sponsor that shares our values over here at OA. So, Shady Rays makes high-quality sunglasses that are available at a fraction of the price of, you know, the expensive brands I'm talking about. So if you're like me and, you know, occasionally you've left your sunglasses on the roof of your car before driving away, or, you know, heard that unsatisfying crunch when you sit down in your seat, right? You will never worry about that again, because every pair of Shady Rays is backed by their industry-leading Lost and Broken Replacements program. So you take them out of the box and break them the second you get, they will send you a replacement pair for free. If you order a pair and you don't like them for any reason, you have 30 days to exchange or return them for a full refund. That's customer service. And as I suggested at the beginning of the ad, with every order, the Shady Rays Impact Program works with nonprofits to benefit children and young adults, like building playgrounds for pediatric cancer patients. So, what's better than getting one pair of Shady Rays and not worrying if you break or lose them? Why? Getting two. So head on over to shadyrays.com/opening. Use our code opening. And for a limited time, when you buy one pair of Shady Rays, you'll get a second pair free. That's shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening to get a second pair of Shady Rays free. shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening. And we would like to welcome to the show Brian Glasser and Carrie Joshi. And Brian and Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So before we get into the details of how you came to represent Robert Zeidman and litigate against Mike Lindell, which I think is a dream of a lot of our listeners, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, about your practice area, about the firm?
Go ahead, Carrie. You can go first.
Even though the name on the door is Brian's, he's going to let me start. That's kind. So I started at Bailey Glasser about 10 years ago, and I actually head up our commercial litigation group. There's about 20 of us in that group. And so this is not necessarily the kind of litigation that I usually do, but Brian was kind and pulled me into it, and I was definitely up for the challenge.
And so I founded this firm back in 99, starting to do CJA cases and really whatever would walk in the door. And since that time, we've grown to do lots of commercial lit, lots of class actions, mass actions. I joke and say we malpractice across broad spectrum of the law.
Okay. So your client here is Robert Seidman, and Talk to us a little bit about how you came to encounter him and, you know, how you got involved in this process.
So I'll take that one. Robert Seidman was an expert witness for a large law firm here in D.C. that I'll keep nameless just because I'm not sure if they, you know, I'm not sure they would want it known that they referred him over. But he had worked for them. He went and did the challenge. And I can get into the reasons why he did that, which may be of interest to you. But in any event, he filed his report saying it's gibberish and garbage and it's not related. This data is not related to the 2020 election. And the three judges declined to pay him. So he went back to that law firm with whom he had worked as an expert witness, asked those lawyers to represent him to bring a claim for the $5 million because they get paid by the hour and don't do contingent work. They referred him to us. And so that's how we got him. It was just a classic referral situation.
So, yeah, we have some questions about how Seidman decided to do it. Could you speak to that at all?
Well, I mean, he was willing to do it. It's just, was there a lawyer willing to do it as well?
To attend Lindell's. We refer to it as a cyber fraud hootenanny. I know that is not a technical term.
Oh, I haven't heard that one. I like that. I like the hootenanny.
So the story is this. Robert Seidman was a Trump voter twice. Mm-hmm. Was also a cyber expert, has something like 12 patents in the area of internet communication protocol and software design and things like that. So a bona fide expert. Mm-hmm. Disposed to want to feel like Trump should be president and was interested in Lindell's claims to have data that showed there had been interference in the 2020 election mm-hmm. by the Chinese. When Mr. Lindell announced the cyber challenge, challenging any expert in the world to come and see the data and prove that it was not data from the 2020 election, Mr. Seidman kind of took up the challenge out of interest. He was curious. When he got there, they presented him with a contract of adhesion, which was the contest rules. The right. contest rules provided that to win, you must prove to 100% certainty that the data was not related to the 2020 election. And if you sign the rules, you also signed up for arbitration, AAA arbitration, which I'm sure you can explain to your listeners, but is basically a private court where Mr. Lindell appointed one arbitrator, a lawyer. We appointed one arbitrator, we being Seidman appointed one arbitrator, and those two arbitrators picked a neutral, picked a third, and that constituted the court. In the end of the day, the three arbitrators all voted in favor of Mr. Seidman and issued something like a 20 or 25 page opinion explaining their reasoning.
Right. I think to go back a little as to why Bob decided to go to the symposium, I don't even think he heard about it on his own at first, but he's in that circle of people who would have heard about it. And they all said to him, hey, Bob, you should go do this thing. And he plays professional poker. And I think one of his professional poker buddies said the same thing. They're like, hey, Bob, this is like something, it's going to be totally interesting. You should go. And he's like, I don't know. And they really encouraged him. And so then he requested, you had to request an invitation and he received one. So I think part of it was as much, you know, other people saying, hey, this is something that that you might really find interesting and you could add value to.
And do you think his perspective was that Lindell did have the goods, or was his perspective that Lindell did not have the goods?
The way it was advertised by Mike himself was that his own experts had vetted everything. And mm-hmm. So in Bob's mind, he's like, well, if he's got a team of experts who have spent 6 months vetting this, I don't know that I can go and say anything different, but I really want to see, like, this could be a history making moment and I want to be there for it. But he didn't necessarily go in thinking I think he gave credit to the data because of how it was advertised, that right. It had been vetted, that people had looked it over, people who knew what they were doing, and that it was authentic. And so he went in with that mindset.
That's really interesting. And so he thought that there was a possibility that Lindell, you know, did have what he said he had.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Now, the trial turned out to be interesting because it turns out that Mr. Lindell purchased this data from a gentleman by the name of Dennis Montgomery, who mm-hmm. resides in Florida mm-hmm. and purported to be able to suck down the entire internet traffic from the election day in his house, and then sold it to Mr. Lindell for $1.75 million.
Oh, my goodness. I had not heard that figure. I know who Dennis Montgomery is, but I did not realize. So did that information come out in the arbitration, or was that public and I just missed it?
No, that came out in the arbitration.
So
and through another case I did some years ago called the Yellowstone Mountain Club case, which we can get into, which is super fun. Mm-hmm. Dennis Montgomery sold some data in that case as well. So it wasn't the first time my career had intersected with Dennis Montgomery, but I...
What are the odds?
Maybe high when it comes to Brian.
In any event, that's where Lindell got the data. Mm-hmm. And then prior to the symposium, a few nights before, Lindell brought in his own experts called the, quote, Red Team.
Right.
He provided the data to the Red Team, and one of the Red Team members named Josh Merritt testified in our trial.
We have questions about Josh Merritt.
Josh Merritt testified that the night before, he told Lindell, you know, you're going to lose. You best call this off. This is not valid data.
Mm-hmm. Did he introduce himself as Spider at the time, or
to us?
Carrie had more dealings with Josh than I, so let me turn it over to Carrie.
No, he did not introduce himself that way. Josh actually was hugely, hugely helpful to us, and mm-hmm. he added a voice of reason and credibility. I certainly think through his deposition testimony at our trial. That was different than the other voices that the panel was hearing, because he was on the inside. He was on this Red Team, but he was new to the Red Team. He wasn't an insider. He didn't know Mike Lindell before he met him on the plane on the way to the Cyber Symposium or the Hootenanny.
Uh-huh.
And he was questioning Mike the whole time, and Mike did not like that. And so that became a real issue. And when Josh was expelled essentially from the Cyber Symposium, he took a lot of heat for questioning the data and questioning the legitimacy of the whole Prove Mike Wrong challenge.
Let me just jump in and give the listeners some background on Josh Merritt, because he is quite an interesting character who did have kind of a face turn. So I don't know whether you guys were familiar with some of that Kraken litigation, where he was billed as kind of a military intelligence expert who had analyzed the data, and he was billed as that by Sidney Powell, the attorney who filed a lot of Kraken litigation, and she called him Spider. That was his code name, and she said he could not be divulged, his identity could not be divulged publicly and or to the court to protect him from would-be assassins or some such. But she was really bad at redacting data, so I believe it was the Washington Post was able to, from the data associated with the files that she uploaded, figure out immediately who he was, and that he was right. Not as billed. He was not the military analyst that he was billed as. And she had a she was, you know, she had other witnesses whom she mislabeled, you know. So, but at the cyber fraud hootenanny, he really was, as I you know, as you said, a voice of reason. He was kind of an honest broker at that trial. I'm not sure he was a dishonest broker in the other trial. He was just sold as something that he wasn't, but that he did function as an honest broker in Sioux Falls at the cyber fraud symposium, and did get treated as a Judas by Lindell and his people, expelled, as you said, and accused of being a CIA plant by Lindell and his team, because he said, you know, this data is garbage. So just that's a little bit of background for the listeners who maybe aren't quite up on all of the ins and outs.
I didn't know that he was the secret Kraken source. So that's
Yeah.
In all our dealings with him, he was very forthright, and we appreciated his, I viewed his honesty in all the interactions we had with him. It felt like he was telling us the truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So did you get to depose him, or how did that shake out?
Yeah. So I spoke with him when I found out that he was out there, and Bob Zeidman knew of him from being there. He kept talking about this person who came from the red team who would provide the data to the cyber experts who were looking at it as part of the Prove Mike Wrong challenge. And he saw the events of the cyber symposium where, you know, Josh came in and was like, here's the data. And then the next day he came in and he provided more data, and he was taking all of the comments from the cyber experts who were saying, what is this? Like, we can't even make heads or tails of this.
Right.
We're all sitting in this room together. This is a waste of time. And Josh, you could tell, was taking that on and agreeing to some extent, like, yeah, I feel bad that I'm not giving all of you people what you came here for, because I haven't seen it either. And then there was this whole thing that apparently happened where Mike Lindell was attacked on one night of the symposium. And so the next day, because of that physical, whatever it was, assault on him, they decided that they needed to not provide some of the data that they were otherwise going to provide. And at that same time, they told Josh, you have to stay in your hotel room and don't come back to the conference. And so there was this sort of like, who knows what that event was? We never got to the bottom of it. It wasn't relevant at all to the issues in our case, but it was clear that there was other drama happening, and that Josh was caught up in all of that as they tried to sideline him.
But I think the key, from my perspective, though, the key of at the trial, of course, Lindell's team was trying to explain why this wasn't all the data, and they chose to give this data instead of all the data, which was terabytes after terabytes, apparently.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter is, in our trial, even Mr. Lindell's own expert ended up basically admitting that as to something like 22 of 24 types of data, he was morally certain it was not valid, authentic, or verifiable.
Right.
So
that was Douglas Gould.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So to me, Lindell had a full and fair opportunity to prove his case in front of a court of his own choosing, and he got slapped off the backboard because it's garbage data.
It really is noticeably garbage. That was really interesting about the spreadsheets being altered. Did you guys want to talk about that? Because that was amazing.
Oh, okay. So you've read the transcripts or whatever. You're the most up-to-date interviewer ever.
I follow Mike Lindell for my beat pretty good. So when you say he was attacked, I have a little bit of the backstory on that. I wouldn't phrase it as an attack. I might phrase it as a fan who hugged him a little aggressively, and he said, now I can't give you my data. This is all your fault.
Yeah. So yeah, that was Gould. And the issue is that the data was supposed to be packet captured data, mm-hmm. which a packet capture, for your listeners, is what happens when data is sent over the internet. It is broken down into smaller pieces called packets. It is sent and then reassembled at the other end into a full original or full piece of data.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lindell had claimed that what he had was, quote, packet captured data, mm-hmm. for the event. And what Gould ended up having to testify to was that none of the things that appeared in the data that, or very few of the things that Lindell presented in the data he presented, actually would go in a packet at
right.
all. And then for the things, I will say, that would be in the deliverable, once the packet's reassembled, there was some obvious craziness going on. For example, there was latitude and longitude. In the data that we had, there were 127,000 entries where people allegedly typed their own latitude and longitude. What's the likelihood of that being true, that 127,000 poll workers in the same 24-hour period or 48-hour period typed their own latitude and longitude out?
Right, right.
It's ridiculous.
Was that the altered spreadsheet?
Yes.
Okay. So, that was very interesting to me in the arbitration award that they talked about that, because that's very clearly, I mean, it looked to me, I'm not sure, I'm a lay person, and I mean, I have a better understanding of it than Mike Lindell, because I've seen him talk about it quite a bit. But it seemed to me that that the issue was that none of it could be time stamped, really. That the data that they gave you, that the interesting thing about the packet capture data, that it was timestamped. Am I correct that that's how you kind of disproved the authenticity of the data?
I wouldn't say the timestamp, because I think I would say that the crushing fact was that 127,000 individuals would have had to type their right. own latitude and longitude into the packet.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, when's the last time you knew your latitude and longitude?
Let's try never.
For the minute.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think one of the things Bob always said to us about it was that, and it was for us at the beginning to try and get our heads around like what this data even is and how do you analyze it and packets and all of that stuff. And what he kept saying was like, it's just so obviously not what it's supposed to be. And I didn't understand that because it looked like nothing to me. And I couldn't understand what the value was or wasn't. And then by the end of the case, our message was just like, this is so far from anything it's purported to be. It's not even close. It's even hard to make an argument about how this might be what it is. And so like Bob had to like educate us to get to the point where we were like, oh, okay, I see what you're seeing. And it's why he was so outraged and frustrated about it all. He's like, it's so obviously bogus.
Carrie, I want to ask you two questions about that. And I want to kind of try and zoom back a little bit, because I am several generations behind technologically in terms of understanding computer data. This is, you know, not saved in Commodore 64 format. So I'm a little struggling to get there. Let me see if I understand kind of the first claim, which we tried to explain on the show, about what packet capture data is. And then I want to ask sort of what the underlying source purported to be. Right. So my understanding is that the claim from Lindell's camp was, we have packet capture data, and if true, because of the way that it is disassembled and reassembled, that would be time-stamped, and that would then be contemporaneous and show in real time votes being altered. And I guess my question is, okay, assume that that's true, right? Like, you could have packet capture data, but it, you know, it could be packet capture data of anything, right? And so where was there ever an articulation of how voting packet capture data was supposed to just kind of be out there in the ether and found by a shady data broker in Florida who's selling it to you, right? Like how, it, help me wrap my head around kind of what the claim was if this were true, because I'm still having a hard time understanding that.
Yeah. It's hard to understand because it's bonkers. But if Brian wants to talk about hammer and scorecard, he should go right ahead.
I would love to.
And that's
going to
set up my
hammers.
Second question, but yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Right, so the core claim of Lindell was that he had packet capture data.
Right.
Zeidemann searched the data that he provided in the something like 28 or 29 known languages that packet captures are communicated in, different computer languages that a packet can exist in. None of those computer languages appeared in any of the data that Mr. Lindell had. So by hypothesis, there is no known communication method for a packet was apparent in that data. So, and Josh Merritt and Mr. Gould both testified there was no packet capture data ultimately provided. So at the end of the day, yes, Lindell said he had packet capture data, but no, he did not provide any. When the put up to shut up time came, there was no packet capture data whatsoever.
Right. But imagine that it had been, right? Like that would still, you would have had a two-step inquiry, right? You would have first said, this is packet capture data, but this is packet capture data of, you know, I don't know, Arby's updating their menu online, right? Like a packet capture can be anything, right?
Well, the story was supposedly that Dennis Montgomery had the ability to, in the way Mike always described it, was you're taking a movie film of the votes happening, and that's what the packet capture data is. So, and again, we never dug into like the specifics of how exactly that was done, because again, it wasn't relevant to what we were looking at. We're like, we have these 9 files. This is our case. Like, that's all we have to do. But in terms of going back to the legend of it all, is that Dennis Montgomery had. He was the one who had some sort of proprietary software where he could go in and record this information going over the internet. And there was actually I think it was a Reuters article that was done about all of this and about Josh Merritt. And it's a good explanation of what the legend is supposed to be. But so if in an alternate reality, if there really were data out there, apparently Dennis Montgomery was able to record it, and it's so much data that you have to compress it, apparently. Mm-hmm. And that compression is also something that Mike apparently paid Dennis Montgomery to do for him. So Dennis sold him the information and then also kindly provided an expensive software to compress it so that they could then manipulate it and work with it and figure out what was in there and prove to the world that there had been election fraud. So it's not a satisfying answer because I don't know that any of it's actually based in fact. But that is the legend that Dennis was able to record the information. He then sold it and compressed it, and all of that went to Mike Lindell.
But for purposes, what I like to focus on is the end game, where mm-hmm. what it is that was provided is nothing like what it was purported to be. Mm-hmm. It's not in any known packet language. It was not, in fact, election data. Because to me, the reason we took this case was because we wanted to prove and get a ruling that it is not true. Because mm-hmm. we think that there's a lot of harm done because a certain segment of society just gloms on and agrees with these conspiracy theories, and there is no evidence. And it feels like it's a little bit frustrating, I'm sure, for all the lawyers who had to fight all the Kraken lawsuits, that you have to run all this to ground and it takes so long mm-hmm. and so much effort mm-hmm. to put the genie back in the bottle. But there's an awful lot of harm. And I would hope that the lesson of all these election denier lawsuits have been lost across the country. All of them. Right. This one may have gone the farthest because it went to an actual judgment on the merits. Mm-hmm. But all of them should show any, you know, thinking observer that you should not immediately default to the idea that our elections are compromised in some way.
Right. Yeah. And I want to jump in on that because it has been a talking point among the election denialists that, you know, these cases were one half for 61, right? Like the half ruling they got was partial relief from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court allowing election observers during a pandemic to move closer to the poll workers counting the ballots. That's the only thing that could remotely be considered a victory. But that being said, the line that is coming out of that camp is, you know, all of these cases were, you know, dismissed procedurally and never adjudicated on the merits. If you look at, for example, the Michigan litigation in King versus Whitmer, right, that decision is 160 pages long, right? Like while these cases were disposed of for, generally speaking, for lack of standing, it's just false, you know, to say that courts didn't look into the merits of what happened. And in particular, in connection with sanctions litigation, right, the court delved into, you know, false affidavits, claims that were just completely made up. And that I wanted to sort of close the loop on the packet capture stuff. I heard you sort of say that this was pitched as packet capture data of real-time election data coming in. votes are not transmitted via the internet. and I know you know that, but I take it there was never an explanation made of sort of how out of a closed box that is not hooked up to the internet, there was supposedly, you know, a live stream capture of voting data coming.
That may have been a way to fight the case. We took a more direct route of just showing the data itself was complete
that
garbage.
It wasn't.
Yeah. It was so much easier to do it that way. The answer was right in front of us, right? We didn't have to go back into all the, we tried to avoid the, really, we wanted to keep it like very serious, straightforward. Here are the, as I said, the 9 files at issue. This is what we're going to talk about. And we're not going to talk about the noise out there. And their side brought the noise in more than we did, for sure. We were really just focused on the factual data in front of us.
Yeah, and as you'd probably have dealt with Kurt Olson in this litigation, I mean, just to circle back to what you said about whether these cases were decided on the merits. In fact, Kurt Olson, and I believe the other attorneys on this case, the attorney Andrew Parker, I believe that they were sanctioned in Arizona in some of the later litigation, and that was a merits decision, right? That they that they made claims about the election software, they made claims about there being no paper trail that were false, and so facially false that they got sanctioned. I mean, they weren't major sanctions, and they're going to fight them ever, but you know, fight them forever. But on behalf of Carrie Lake, the gubernatorial candidate in Arizona, they did get a merits determination, and the merits determination was you have filed something that no attorney would have filed had they done a modicum of research. In fact, they got sanctioned with Alan Dershowitz, Andrew's former professor. Was he
yours too, Brian? Right?
Yes, that's true.
so you dealt with Kurt Olson in this case because Olson and Parker, you know, Andrew Parker, they represent Lindell in a lot of his other litigation, and Olson was the one who wrote the rules for this, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. And Olson was one of the three judges and testified at the trial. I don't think we ever took his deposition, did we, Carrie?
Yes, I did. Oh, so you did. Kurt Olson he wrote the rules. Uh-huh. He was a judge. He was a witness in our trial because we took his deposition. So not in our trial, but, you know, he had factual information. During that deposition, he also let us know that he was an attorney on the case, our case. And so he kind of wore every hat you could possibly wear. And so there was attorney-client privilege claimed, but then there was lots of things he wanted to talk about. And so we were trying to figure out the whole time, like, what is his role in all of this? But yeah, he has his finger in everything.
I don't know what the disqualification rules are in the AAA commercial arbitration rules, but I mean, I assume you were happy to have him wear all the hats just because it increased the likelihood that he would, you know, waive attorney-client privilege by testifying about it or the like.
Yeah, again, I think there were moments where, so they, the other kind of fact along those lines were that they told us they had no emails or text messages about the Prove Mike Wrong challenge at all. None whatsoever. And each person had a different story about why it was that they didn't have any communications. So someone was like, I only talked on the phone about it. Mm-hmm. Kurt Olson's was that his phone was, something happened to his phone. And when he picked it up from the AT&T store, his texts were no longer on it because they had erased his texts or something like that. So we didn't have any,
as they do.
Yeah, we didn't have any documentary evidence, but rather than like going to the arbitration panel and saying, hey, we want to compel some sort of production, we just didn't deal with the silliness. We were like, we don't need it. We have in front of us exactly what we need. And if we can just keep the noise out, we're going to be able to present a very clear, sensical, not in the craziness universe that this whole thing was operating in, not the hootenanny, but just the facts. Mm-hmm. And that was better for our case all the way.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that not wanting to get into it. I mean, from our perspective, we really wish that you had gotten into it. Did you get to depose Mike Lindell?
Yeah, I deposed Mike in Minneapolis. Yep.
Wow.
Okay, you've got to tell us how that went.
He testified as well at the trial. So we've
he testified at the trial too.
He's quite a character. Is he the same person in, you know, behind the scenes as he is when he's on Steve Bannon having scream therapy every day? Or
so it's funny. I was talked to someone else who had deposed him, and he read the transcript of our deposition. He said, wow, you really got a lot more out of him than I did. Apparently Mike just yelled at this guy the whole time. He was perfectly polite. And he answered my questions, and his testimony at our trial was very similar to his deposition testimony. Like he had his set of facts and, or his version of events, and he went through them, and it didn't stray very far from that. So yeah, I hadn't watched a lot of Mike Lindell's performances prior to his deposition. So it was kind of all new to me. It was really interesting. Like, he has an interesting life story, right? And he's a salesman. He's good at talking about these things. And so, I mean, for me, the deposition was really fun. But you know, it wasn't, there wasn't anything particularly earth shattering. He deferred to a lot of the people who work for him about details and things like that. So
do you think he sincerely believed that he had top secret election data that proved that, you know, millions of votes were converted from Trump to Biden by Italian space lasers or what have you?
Well, that's a long pause.
I mean,
I'm going to let Brian answer.
It's hard to get in the mind of another human, but I would say that he wants desperately to believe it's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he's, look, I observe him a lot. He's promised, you know, he promised about 15 times that the Supreme Court was going to overturn the 2020 election.
Nine to nothing.
I've watched multiple of his movies on this topic. So that's how I know he doesn't understand packet capture data either. So, I mean, I did not understand after watching his movie, but it is interesting to me. He says, he's constantly saying in 2 weeks, I'm going to give you this data. And for someone who believes that what he has is genuine, he does have a knack for finding a way not to give you the data that he says. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, he needs to look, and he certainly has viable claims, in my judgment, against the person who sold him the data.
Yeah.
I mean, good luck. You know.
Yeah.
Good luck collecting.
Well, Brian, one of the things you said that, you know, you found rewarding and that was an inspiration for taking the case was to play a role in combating, you know, really, really dangerous conspiracy theories that are, you know, unfortunately kind of permeating the space. And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that, particularly, you know, from the perspective of, right, co-founder of a very successful law firm and, you know, a lot of, I'm pretty willing to be out there with where I stand politically, but, you know, a lot of lawyers kind of take the view of people who wear MAGA hats need legal representation too. And talk a little bit about, like, the politics of the decision and how that intersected with, you know, with the business decision.
So our firm will let people do. I mean, this case, I don't think we may never collect. It was not taken. We didn't take this case because we think Lindell Management LLC has anything more than a couple of computers. Okay.
Oh, interesting.
And so we always knew there's going to be a collectability issue here. He's not going to pay. And of course, we'll take discovery native execution, and that could be fun. But at the end of the day, we took the case because I wanted to prove that this was not real data and that this was false. And I thought it was important. Now, we let anybody in our firm basically do pro bono work that they find interesting and important. We don't have a political litmus test for that. I can't remember anything that I'm sure there are plenty of cases that some people have brought that I would disagree with. But we basically, one of the beauties of a smaller firm is one of the things we give people is freedom to do those things that interest them. So we do, you know, we've had a lot of interesting cases like this along the way. I don't know if that answers your question, but we don't really have a set policy.
Yeah.
Right. But you're being in West Virginia. Are you going to have blowback because of this, you think?
Oh, well, you know, we got plenty of people who are Trump voters who are clients, and we're happy to have them and proud to represent them. But, you know, people, to me, what do you try not to talk politics and religion, right? You got the business at hand.
You may not have come on the best show for that for that maxim, but I do want to talk about the collectability. I want to unpack that a little bit for the listeners, particularly the non-lawyer listeners. So what I heard you just say that it creates the impression that due to the contract, that the specific judgment that was awarded here may be difficult to enforce in terms of producing an entity that's going to write a multi-million dollar check at any point. And so I guess the first procedural question I would ask is, have you moved to confirm the arbitration award?
So the 30 days haven't run yet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Probably need
to I'll draft it up. Just got to press send.
Okay.
And you'll go to a district court, a federal district court in Minnesota to get that.
Correct.
That's right.
And just before we move on that, Mike Lindell has said, right, you know, he intends to fight this one all the way up to the Supreme Court. Whatever. And do you anticipate that there's going to be, you know, a counterclaim to, you know, modify or to vacate the arbitration award or?
So we will move to confirm. There's no doubt that he will try to overturn it or quash it. As you probably know, the standard at law is that he has to prove manifest injustice, which in the face of this reasoned opinion is impossible in my judgment.
Yeah.
And so that won't happen. And it'll be confirmed.
Ours too. We have opined that on the show.
It'll be confirmed. And then at that point, the federal rules of civil procedure give us the ability to take discovery and aid of execution. He'll have to make a decision whether he wants us to unpack what Lindell Management exactly is and has been over time, and whether it's a real entity or not, and whether we can pierce the corporate veil or collapse corporations and go through that corporate entity that we have the judgment against to the rest of the Lindell universe. We will obviously try and do that with all our power. So he's just going to have to make a hard decision about how much he wants to put at risk.
Let's unpack both parts of that answer here. So first, discovery and aid of execution. Right? Our listeners know about discovery, right? That is the ability to seek documents and testimony. And specifically, once you've gotten a judgment, that would be questions about assets.
That's right. And about the movement of money to and through the corporation. When the corporation entered the contract for $5 million, did it have the capacity to pay, or was it ephemeral even at that moment? Mm-hmm. It may be the case that Lindell Management's a super important entity in his world. I doubt it. I don't know yet, but we will find out.
That's interesting because the rules specify that you had to go through the Lindell Legal Department or the MyPillow Legal Department. Right. which we thought was pretty funny that they have a legal department? Do we think they do?
Yeah. Well, they have Kurt Olson. They have at least
they have an in-house counsel too. I can't remember his name. Apparently, he was part of Kurt Olson's deposition. He talked about him.
But I mean, obviously, for Mr. Zideman's sake, we hope that Mr. Lindell's bluffing, and that once the court confirms the judgment, he'll pay it.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm just wondering from your perspective, it seemed to me strange that nobody else brought this kind of a challenge because, you know, it seemed just from the outside, it seemed pretty clear that Lindell never really had what he said he had. I'm just wondering why Zideman was the only taker.
I think there's a couple. Well, first of all, he's the only person who actually filed a report at the thing. So he was the only available person who did the procedural things you had to do to qualify.
Right.
But secondly, if you actually fly spec the contract, you had to, the standard of proof was 100% certainty. And the venue was in front of a judge, at least one of which was chosen by Lindell. So I think that put some people off the idea that maybe it was the thing they could win on.
Interesting. Yeah. Right. Because Lindell, when he complained and said he was going to sue and get the verdict overturned, also complained about the arbitrators and said that they were all Democrats and it was totally stacked against him.
Well, he chose one of them, so.
Yeah.
We actually chose together the two arbitrators. The way it was supposed to be set up was we chose an arbitrator, they chose an arbitrator, and those two chose the chair. But we were having so much trouble agreeing on the chair that actually we, with Lindell's attorneys, chose the chair. So there was a lot of choice on the part of Lindell's side in at least two of the three. So it's very disingenuous to say that it was in some way skewed towards us.
It's interesting. It's the second arbitration I've ever done where the party appointed arbitrator voted against the party appointing. So it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's a testament to how unambiguous the data is, right?
That and the and I think those the arbitrators took it super seriously. They were, you know, real lawyers with real deep backgrounds. They were an impressive bunch, and we were very glad to have their attention, and they put out a really good product. Mm-hmm. It's a good opinion.
That's yeah, really interesting. I agree.
Yeah, it was, and eminently readable. I think that they were pretty clear that this was going to be read by, you know, like how many people are reading most arbitration, right. You know, awards.
It
like,
may be the most read arbitration verdict in America this year.
For sure. I mean, you know, I wrote
last
about
month.
It, but like I write for lawyers in the main. I think most of these, you know, I think that they had an understanding that this was going to be read by a lay audience pretty widely.
And Mike's team did try and keep it all confidential. They wanted a confidentiality order, but we briefed it and the panel ruled against them on confidentiality.
Oh, that's really interesting. So they wanted to keep this part under wraps and
correct.
they lost.
Yeah.
Which they could have put in the contract that they drafted.
That Kurt Olson drafted. Yeah.
Robert Zeidman to sign. I wish we had another hour to kind of go line by line on that contract because that was a truly special work product. but I really appreciate Brian and Carrie you making yourselves available here today. I want to ask you one trailing question. Feel free not to answer it. But Brian, Carrie, I believe you're based out of DC, but Brian, you're based out of Charleston, West Virginia, right?
Actually I moved over to DC myself too a few years back.
Okay.
There's more clients over here. Charleston, West Virginia, population 50,000, can't really support the law firm size it's become.
I read a quote from you, Brian, that said, every big case starts with a colossal error in poor judgment, and it's your job to sort it out, and if that's not fun, what could be? And I have to say that was so funny that it was so apropos of this case because, you know, there have been, well, not one colossal error of judgment, but this whole cyber fraud hootenanny appeared to be a terrible error in judgment. So it seemed pretty apropos.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, so I live over here, Andrew, so we can have a beer one day. That'd be fun.
Absolutely. We'll come down and we'll grab coffee. So are you still kind of tied in with the West Virginia political scheme? So I want to pick your brain for, you know, 30 seconds on Joe Manchin's reelection prospects in 2024, if you have thoughts about that.
I think Joe Manchin, if he chooses to run, could win. Now, it is the case, should win. It is the case that West Virginia is very MAGA and was the most. Well, Trump won West Virginia by the most votes of any state in America, right?
Yeah, like 35 points.
And Joe Manchin is the only statewide elected Democrat left. But I promise you, he knows everyone in the state. And so I feel like if he decides he wants to keep his job, he will keep it. He will
really
win that.
That's really interesting.
He's an excellent, excellent retail politician. Every single person in West Virginia has some story about how they know him personally, and he'll do a good job. Now, Mr. Justice, he's popular right now. He has a high approval rating.
Yeah.
So, and I've noticed, you know, we have a big office in Charleston. We have an office in Morgantown. I get the media there. I keep up. And definitely the National Republican interest groups are already running negative ads against Manchin in West Virginia. So. It'd be a fight, but I believe he would prevail.
Excellent.
All right. Well, let's we will pay attention and thanks for being willing to go out on that limb there. Carrie, Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show. Anything you want to add as we wrap it up?
Thanks for having us.
No, I just appreciate you guys having us.
Absolutely. Keep doing great work out there in terms of debunking the big lie.
You guys too. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
This is an ad for Green Chef. Now, I know what you're thinking. Andrew, don't you do ads for HelloFresh? Well, turns out Green Chef is owned by HelloFresh. So, with a wider array of meal plans to choose from, there's something for everyone. OABE listeners can enjoy both brands at a discount. And Green Chef has so many options. Keto, protein-packed, vegan, vegetarian, fast and fit, Mediterranean, gluten-free. They are the only keto meal kit. So, you know, if you're counting carbs, like in my family, Green Chef makes sticking to that lifestyle easy. You know I love to cook. You also know how overworked I am, and I love the convenience of Green Chef. You can choose from among more than 30 recipes every week and even mix and match dietary preferences in the same box without changing your plan. So, you know, order vegan meals one day, keto the next. Green Chef doesn't care. And now, here's the deal. What do you think of 60% off and free shipping? Sound too good to be true? Head on over to greenchef.com/OA60 and use code OA60 to get 60% off plus free shipping. That's right. Go to greenchef.com/OA60. Use promo code OA60 to get 60% off plus free shipping. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well.
And we are back. I think we learned a lot in that interview. It's certainly wild to see Spider Merritt treated as the unlikely hero. Did not see that one coming.
If you tell me that Terpsichore was one of the heroes, though, like, how about?
Yeah, no, I don't think that one's coming. No. But one of the ongoing issues we found out about is that the party responsible for paying the $5 million prize is an outfit called Lindell Management LLC that just so happens to share an address and a legal department with MyPillow, the MyPillow headquarters, I suppose, in Chaska, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And we found out that the lawyers intend to conduct discovery about that entity to try and go after its assets, which we're not mad about.
Yeah.
So that can go either one of two ways. Either Lindell Management LLC really does have $5 million to pay out. Hooray. Or if it doesn't, Bailey Glasser will have a good argument that it was a sham entity and they can, you know, pierce the corporate veil and go after either Mike Lindell and or MyPillow, which can both afford to pay the $5 million.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, we also learned that for all his bluster, Mike Lindell had an awful lot of input in this process, right? Mm-hmm. His lawyer, Kurt Olson, drafted the contract. It was offered to all of the participants on a take it or leave it basis, right? That was the continuing references to contract of adhesion. The contract specified that you had to arbitrate any claims and not
in
go
Minnesota.
To trial. Yeah, in Minnesota. And that arbitration was, you can conduct an arbitration in front of a single arbitrator, but no, this one had to be before a 3-judge panel. And we learned that Lindell had his fingerprints all over 2 of those arbitrators. So, you know, in public, when he's talking to the Gateway pundit or whatever, Lindell might make a bunch of mouth noises about, I don't know, suing all the way to the Supreme Court to overturn this unfair arbitration verdict of Democrats that were out to get Donald.
Yeah, like, he did say that.
Oh, yeah. But 2 out of 3 of them were pretty much handpicked by him. And I would not be surprised to discover that that bluster does not translate into, you know, an actual lawsuit. But we'll see.
Uh-huh.
And that means we will have yet another opportunity to talk about Mike Lindell, or better or worse.
Oh, my God. He's never going away. He'll be here until the earth like falls into the sun.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's only, what, 5 billion years away? So, yeah.
He'll still be screaming at Steve Bannon.
Oh, God. Well, that's the show. Liz, thanks so much for being here. And thanks again to Brian Glasser and Kerry Joshi for coming in, doing this interview and giving us a behind the scenes peek at what it's like to, you know, depose and litigate against Mike Lindell.
That was awesome. Thanks, guys.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Liz. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, with assistance from Teresa Gomez and Deborah Smith.
Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. Copyright 2023. All rights reserved.